We are here to celebrate our friend George Wheatley's life.
As I said before, welcome everybody that came from out of town, local. It's great to see you all. Some faces I haven't seen in many, many years. So George and I met in 1972 when I started working at Shoko in the accounting department under Kevin McNevins. It was early July, and we were just a skeleton crew in the office at the Quadrangle because everyone was in the Poconos for a big outdoor rock show. A few months later, we merged and moved from the Quadrangle and Motor Circle to 9/11 Governor's Row. It was a magical time in all of our lives, and George was a big cog in the party wheel. I had lots of parties, and George was always there. I thought I'd only have a few pictures for the slideshow, but it turns out I've found more than about 70 of them. A testament to how well we partied. As many people have attested, George wasn't shy about telling you what he thought about anything, and his words always contained flowery language, which just added to the hilarity and the charm of what he said. And I'll bet he was born with expletives coming out of his mouth. George was a clothes horse, always neatly dressed, never sloppy. He was also very private, and he didn't want to get out much after he started getting sick. That's why it was such an enormous feat to get him to the party here in December of 24. When JR went to get him in East Texas, brought him to his house in Salina, and then to the party here that day. Everyone was so happy to see him, and I think that he was glad he came. George also had impeccable handwriting. I was always so impressed when I'd read anything he'd written. George was a great friend who I miss very much, as do all of you I know. Always stay in touch so we can keep our family together. And in that light, just one tribute that I did print out by Paul Kalanick. He said, I was accepted into Shoko through an internship program with a fledgling Full Sail school, which at that time was a 6-week workshop in its third year of existence. I stayed at the Value Inn on Airport Freeway and worked unpaid in the warehouse for about a month. At the end of that time, George offered me a position on a tour. I think it was the Moody's. I thanked him very much, but had decided the life on the road would be too demanding, and I wasn't up for it. Went back to waiting tables in Orlando. Soon realized I had totally screwed up and started calling George on a regular basis, begging to be given another chance. The same week I lost my restaurant job, George called asking if I could be in Dallas in 3 days. I said, hell yeah, and took off. When I got to Dallas, I got a plane ticket to Denver and joined the Bon Jovi Slippery When Wet tour, all because George saw potential and believed in me. I retired this past year after 40 years in the business, thanks primarily to George Wheatley. Forever grateful to him and everyone else at Shoko who helped me along. What a ride. P.S. I also have to mention hanging with George outside the loading dock after I had quit smoking after 20 years. He was smoking. I said, George, I thought you quit. He pulled up his sleeve and showed me a nicotine patch on each arm and said, I'm trying. He said, I'm effing trying. So one of the brief ones was Gary Martin. And who remembers Mayonnaise Martin? Were you really? Gary was supposed to come, but he didn't make it. He wrote, I met George on Motor Circle. Always smoking, always working, always approachable, and always cool. And Lonnie, do you want to say what you were going to say, or do you want me to read it? Okay. My first memory of George was Motor Circle. We're not driving White Cloud. Remember that? Around gophering, I was tasked with doing whatever I could to assist George. Me being a green, barely 21-year-old newbie, he was a little intimidating, to say the least. Over the years, I grew to recognize the big-hearted soul he was. George, you will be missed. And Mo Eddie, if it wasn't for George Wheatley, I would have never met my soulmate. One day, while prepping for a Moody Blues, George came out of his office, and I had a conversation. He strongly advised me to go to the Genesis We Can't Dance Tour 1992. I met Ann during some time off in Nottingham, and my life has been blessed ever since. Thank you, George, for always being there for us. And here's one from Mike Allison. He said, I talked on the phone with George before I met him. me and the Garrett brothers were invited to Dallas to do an internship. It was 1986. I think George had that deep voice that made you think that George should be this 7-foot giant. When we arrived to 201 Regal Row, the three of us walked into the front entry, trying to remember who was at the desk, maybe Angela. We asked for George and had a seat. It took about 10 minutes, and we spent the time looking at all the records and awards on the wall. Out of the back came this stick-thin, around 5'8" guy. There was no way this could be him. When he spoke, I almost fell on the floor. There was no way that voice was coming out of him. Now, we got signed in and put right to work. The three of us were sent to work with Cowboy removing... This is so funny. Removing the insides of old AX cabinets to make a cable area. It was a long, hard day of work, and finally, cleanup was screamed by the dude. As the three of us were walking out, George stops and asks how it went. I can't remember if I was told if it was Todd or Tyler. He asked George if we should invite Cowboy to come stay with us. George laughs and asks why. Well, he said, he thought Cowboy was living on the street. Again, George laughs and asks why. He smells. He smells like he'd not showered in a month. At that, George really laughs out loud. When he can speak again, George says, Cowboy does have a manly smell about him, but he does not need to stay with you. George was always very good to me. The Thrasher, Bruce Thatcher. Beyond what could be considered a gruff exterior, George was a people person. He had to be. Anyone who had to manage all of us road dogs, band mixers, etc., you had to have that skill. George was able to talk with each person the way they needed. He got results. When I was a snot-nosed kid, he told me the importance of making a connection with crews as varied as hardened Teamsters to crappy college gig labor. For goodness sakes, George convinced me to do the ministry tour twice. When I became a part of Shoco Operations, I remembered saying to George, I just don't see how you do it, managing all these guys. He brushed off the compliment and said to me, but on the good side, I don't have to track thousands of pieces of gear. I replied, yeah, but when I send the gear somewhere, the gear doesn't talk back. Rest in peace, Mr. Wheatley. Godspeed. And that's all I've got. For everybody else, you are invited to step forward.
No hecklers. No hecklers, please. No, I just wanted to start at the beginning, actually. George was hired by Rusty to do the Led Zeppelin tour in 1971. He was a friend of Debbie's. And we were just bonded there. As you can tell, I was a little larger than George. George got the nickname Mike Stand. I got the nickname Bass Box. So we had a great time. Worked together real well. Rusty, maybe you want to comment about this, but ended up Led Zeppelin in the Forum in Los Angeles. And we loaded everything out. I realized that we had the tape from the console, the mix of the entire show, 2 hours tape. So we're playing it, and these girls were attracted by George, I guess. And so we said, we're heading to Dallas. Want to go? So they jumped in the truck, and I was driving. So I drove all night. Well, it wasn't actually all night. It was till the morning. George got busy in the sleeper with one of the girls, and I just listened to Led Zeppelin's tape all night long. So we let him out in Yuma, Arizona, and said goodbye. Anyway, from that time on, George and I were sort of bonded. A month later, we did the James Taylor loadout in San Diego. very similar circumstance. But this time we're in Percy, the truck that many people remember. There were two trucks. There were Ford cab overs. And they turned out to be complete dogs. We named Tiny named one of them Hoover because it sucked. And I named the other one Percy because it had no balls. And the what?
Loretta and Myrtle.
Loretta and Myrtle were in the first vintage.
Oh.
Loretta was the scene of the first time with Led Zeppelin and all that. But we'd taken on the James Taylor tour and picked up the Ford trucks. At that time, the Ford trucks had these really little sleepers. They were like shelves on the back, and there was a net that kept you from falling on the driver. So we had to come all straight back to Dallas, and we came to a place called Cisco, which is, for historic purposes, the housing of the first Conrad Hilton Hotel, the Mobley Hotel in Cisco, Texas. And I was asleep, and George took the exit. He mostly took the exit, but we ended up bouncing around on the access road, and I was thrown all over the back of the truck. These windshields on these cab overs were just huge, and all I could see was grass. There were a couple of cows in the field. George went through I hesitate to mention this, Rusty, but it's too late to worry about. Bouncing around, and George kept the truck rolling. We got back on the access road, got back up, went over to the coffee shop. I didn't know what to say. So we got out of the truck, went over and sat down at the counter. And I finally looked at George and I said, "Nice exit." And you know what George said? "Yeah." But from that time on, we've been, I've loved George. Always had great respect. I've included him in my address to the introduction of the new expense reports with my gentleman and George Wheatley. Many people remember that. But what can you say? Except I love you, George. I love you, Sherry, for putting all this stuff together. I want to hear something from somebody else. Somebody else that loves George.
I'm John Ray, affectionately known as JR. And I'm not going to talk about trucks or bands, but I do want to talk about kind of the George's, the last days that we remember of George. George fell at his home in late spring of 23 and hit his head and broke his leg. He didn't know he broke his leg, but he did. And so George and I used to talk at least once a week. And he called me, and he was at Parkland Hospital. And I said, "What are you doing at Parkland?" He said, "Well, they took me here because I hit my head." And George has numerous heart problems over the years. And he was upset that he was at Parkland because he felt like he needed to be taken to Medical City where all of his treatment had been done. They said, "No, you're at Parkland because you hit your head, and that's where you belong." And so we talked on, and then come to realize that he had had surgery for a broken leg and didn't know it. And so we tried to figure out what we were going to do once he got released from the hospital. But before that could even happen, he got evicted from his house. And his landlord put him on the street. He thought that house was going to be a teardown. And at some point it probably will, but in this case it was not. The owner just wanted to fix it up and re-rent it. So we moved George out, and I took him to my house in Salina, and that was in summer of 23, and I was going through physical therapy to try to repair a bad hip and managed to get George in with my physical therapist. And he was on a walker and still rehabilitating the broken leg. And my therapist, on about the third or fourth session, said, just spotted him in the middle of the room and went and made him sit down. Said, you know, you can't do these exercises. And everybody thought it was because of his heart. Well, we kind of moved on from that, and late in August, he had a medical episode in my living room at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and we managed to call 911 and get the EMTs in there and evacuate him to McKinney, and they put him in the ER and ICU. And then transferred him over to a rehab center to try to get that leg working normally. And after that, he came back to stay with me. And I said, if anybody needs assisted living, it's you. You need to be where somebody can care for you. It got to the point where I was afraid to go to town and buy groceries because I didn't want to be gone for 30 minutes. So we made arrangements with his brother and moved to Carthage, Texas, and stayed with his brother for 3 or 4 months and then went to an independent facility in Longview. And he was doing well there and making slow, steady progress. And then the next thing I know, boom, he bounced back into the hospital again. And this happened 2 or 3 times and in the hospital, back out of the hospital. Turns out I had a friend that was a chief of ER at the hospital he was in and didn't realize it at the time. So I called Brian and I said, you know, you've got a friend of mine in there and everybody's treating him for a heart condition and it's not really effective. I don't think we got it right. And he came back in 48 hours and said, he's got COPD. He said, he can't breathe. And, looking back on it, there was a lot of little hints that was what was going on. He when he was staying with me, he had a CPAP machine. And I use a CPAP machine because I got sleep apnea. But little old skinny George, I said, George, you don't have sleep apnea, do you? And he goes, no. And I said, well, what are you doing with a CPAP machine? He goes, it helps me breathe at night. And so he was kind of self-diagnosing. He was doing this all his own. And it was kind of working. But so they started treating for COPD, and that was the right thing to do. But back to when he was living with me, just kind of a little insight into George. He was a very minimalist kind of guy, right? And he was thrown out of his house. He hadn't had his change of address yet. Wasn't getting mail. Wasn't getting his bills. He was, you know, there was some turmoil going on. We had to get that straightened out. And so he's over here working like crazy on his phone and his checkbook. And I go, George, what are you doing? He goes, I'm trying to pay bills, you know. And I said, you're doing this on the phone? He said, yeah. You know, he would call his bank or whatever the institution was, get a statement, and then write a check and mail it to him. And I went, man, that's the hard way. And I said, why don't we figure out a better way to do that? And he said, well, what do you have in mind? And I said, well, let's get you online. Well, George was a little technology adverse when it came to being. He didn't engage in Facebook. He didn't engage in any kind of social media. But he had two telephones. And I said, George, why do you have two phones? And he said, well, one's to talk on and the other one's for text. You're kidding me. And he goes, no. And I said, you can text on your regular phone. No, I don't do that. You know? Okay. So I'm beginning to see what kind of a hill I've got to climb here. So I just jumped out and went and bought him an iPad. And we went to technology boot camp for about 8 weeks every day. And we got him registered. We got that, got him online, did online banking, showed him how to do mail, showed him how to do music, showed him all this kind of stuff. He was in hog heaven. And his iPad was a very, very trusted device at that point. But he, I'll never forget the idea. Two phones, one for texting, one for calling. But he, the other thing about George that y'all all probably realize, he had the best bullshit detector of anybody I've ever met. And he could size up a person or a situation in about 5 seconds and form an opinion, and that was it. That's what we're going with, you know. And if you wanted to change that in any way, you had to go to boot camp to do it, right? But stayed with him to the end. He and I stayed in touch every week, and sometimes there toward the end every day. And we were little known fact. I was just telling Johnny Roberts that George was a fairly successful stock investor. I don't know if many people knew that. Self-taught, didn't have an advisor, didn't have any. He read a lot. He explored on his own, and was doing very well. But it was just all equities and. 76 years old and not at all diversified. And finally, I said, George, you gotta figure out a way to smooth some of this stuff out. You know, you're doing good, but you're really at risk here. And he said, well, what would you do? And I said, if it were me, I said, I'd sell everything right now. And he called me back the next day, and he said, I did. I sold everything. And I go, you're serious? And he goes, yeah. And I said, that was amazing. But he said, now I got to figure out something to do with it. And he was kind of looking long term. He wanted an income stream where he, you know, didn't have to be hands on with that portfolio of his every day. And so we were going to set that up. And he had asked me to be a partner with him on a conference call with Fidelity, and had it all set up. And I told him, I said, I don't have power of attorney or anything. We did get him a will while he was with me. I made him do that. And for all of y'all in here, do that. Do not leave your stuff at risk for the state, because they will do what they want with it. But he, we had this conference call set up, and I told him, I said, you're going to have to be the one in charge here, and you're going to have to tell the people on the other end what I'm doing here. And he said, that's fine. And all I had was the number to call in, and the time came and went, and the phone didn't ring, and I gave it another 5 minutes, and then another five, and finally I just called Fidelity and got the gal, and she said, I haven't heard from him. And I said, have you tried to reach him? She said, yeah, we have, and we can't get hold of him. So we started scrambling, and it turns out that they had put him on life support 48 hours before that call. And on that morning, they had actually removed him from life support. And so, but he, his timing was impeccable all the way to the very end. He had his affairs in order. He got his stocks sold, and he was in good shape. But we miss him. He was a great guy.
I'm Steve Harris. Many of you know me. Some don't. Some came after. I was at Shoco from 76 till about 84. George both preceded me and succeeded me. I was I was on the road for about 4 years, and then I was back off the road and working in the shop as sound maintenance supervisor for a number of years. And when I left, George had come back to Shoko and took over from me there. My story about George is about, it's not a terribly exciting story, but it's a story about something you all know about George. There was a time in the shop where I think he had come back to Shoko, and I have never had superior vision. And there was a few road folks, could have been some of you, but I'm not sure, who were giving me a real hard time about that, because I wasn't perfect in everything I did. But George made a comment to them. He said, hey, you know, back off. He's doing just fine. And one thing I remember about George is that one time where he stood up for me, and he had known me for a while, and know I do a pretty good job, but a couple of the folks had shown that Shoko was a different type of place. I have another story to tell you about Shoko right after this, but it's a time when you had to kind of stand up for yourself. And I came to Shoko. I was kind of an introverted person, but you can't really be introverted on the road. You have to be really out there and working with all that's going on. And so George kind of helped me out with that and a number of other things at Shoko. So I appreciate that from George in particular. But the one thing I wanted to say is the second thing I have. All of you folks here, everything that's gone on with Shoko, whenever anybody asks me about what I've done with my life, what I remember, I've had a number of jobs after Shoko. There is nothing that I remember like all the times that I spent with Shoko and all the people who are a family. You hear that all the time, but are a family and have kept in touch and kind of know each other, know what's going on, and remember the life on the road, which is almost impossible to tell anybody about. It's a lot of stories that everyone has, and they are great stories to hear everybody tell about. And I've remembered those from, like when I went to my 10th and 20th high school reunion, people don't grasp what you, what you've done on the road. I had all my stage passes out once for the reunions, and they kind of look at them and they can't grasp what this life is all about. It's something that I remember. I can't, well, of all the things that I've done, I worked on a cruise line for a while, which was a neat job. I was the sound supervisor for SeaWorld of San Antonio when it opened. A lot of things that I thought were really fun, and I did. But there's one thing I remember, and if I ever talk to anybody about things that I've done, it's Shoko. And it was a great life. I'm normally not a public speaker, but after a couple of rum and cokes, I decided I needed to get up here and say what this is all about and how much I appreciate my time with Shoko. Lewis Lee was responsible for me even being there at all. He called me up and told me they were hiring. And so I went up there, and that was the beginning of something that was one of the most memorable things I've ever done in my life. So at the young age of 73, I appreciate that, and I appreciate all of you, Rusty, and, of course, everybody who started this amazing thing, Shoko, and greatly appreciated. So I want to thank you all. And the time I had, that's about all I can say. But greatly appreciated everything about Shoko and you folks.
Well, I'm David Barnett, and I first met George on Motor Circle. And Donnie Kretschmar was who directed me toward Motor Circle. Said they were hiring a Shoko, and I walked in. Turned out Rusty Brucher was running the company, and I had gone to college with Rusty. And one of the first things George bequeathed me was I became Rusty's roadie. with Led Zeppelin. And I forgave George for that eventually. And after two tours with Zeppelin and several others, I switched over to driving. Tiny broke me in as a semi-driver. And George had come out. Now, this time, George was in the office pretty much full-time, running everything that Sherry didn't. And George had come out and ended up riding with me, I think, between Nashville and Knoxville on I-40 one day. And it had probably been a little bit too long since either one of us had had any sleep. And as I recall, on the doghouse of the tractor, we had a pack of Camels, unfiltered, a box of toothpicks, about a dozen Snickers bars, and two or three six-packs of warm Pepsi-Cola. And we finished them all. And at one point, George dropped something. And he could get a little flustered at times. And he kept trying to find it, and he could not find it. And finally, he just looked up and he said, "Damn it, I don't know whether to shit or go blind." And I said, "George, why don't you just sprint and fart?" And every time after that, then I would come back into the office, into the shop on Governor's Row, even if I couldn't see him in there, I'd hear somebody yell across the room, "Sprint and fart!" George, how are you? As I think back about it now, George, in many respects, of all the different hats that he wore as Shoko, George was the glue that held a lot of us together. And I think this shows that he still does. I love you, George.
I'm Jonathan Babiak. I was Chris Babiak at Shoko. I was there briefly in the 1980s. And it's good to know that the landlord didn't get George's money. God damn it. So, Sherry, Bob, we love you. Thank you so much for putting this together. Big hand for Sherry and Bob. So, George did not fuck around. I got back from New Zealand after the end of the David Bowie tour in 1983. I'm exhausted. I'm not scheduled to do anything. So I decided I'm just going to stay at home for a week. I'll go to the shop next week. And I'm asleep in bed, and phone rings. "Hello." "Gotcha." "Hi, George. Listen, Babiak, you need to pack. Get to the Bronco Bowl on Saturday morning. You're going out with Motley Crue." This is 1983. Motley Crue was not a big thing yet. "Okay, George, what's Motley Crue?" That was it.
I'm Randy Birch, and I started at Shoko. Well, I came to Shoko because I went to Full Sail. So I was the first intern ever to come from Full Sail. So anyway, I talked to John Blasuda, because Full Sail really at that time didn't have a connection with Shoko. And they, but anyway, I said, "You get me a name and a number, and I'll figure it out." So I called JB and I said, explained to him that I'd come work for 6 weeks for free. After that, if it didn't work out, you don't owe me anything. So long story short, I showed up at Shoko January the 13th, 1986. So I go in the front door, and I wait and look at the pictures on the wall. And then someone comes out. It's George. He introduces himself. Hey, I'm George Wheatley. And I said, I'm Randy Burge, here to do an internship. So we went back. So the first thing I had to do, Cool and the gang had done a New Year's Eve show in Houston, and they blew up all the tweeters, those little 4281 tweeters. So that was my job. This first thing I did was pull all of them out. So the next day, I was had to do some stuff, and Al Childress was the recon guy at that time, which I would become the recon guy later. And anyway, so I go back, and I've got a bunch of 18s. I've got a brand new recon, beautiful 18s. I go to put one back in the base bin, and I run the T-handle right through the cone, and it just rips it. And I think, well, I guess I better pack my bags. I'm probably out of here. Anyway, George happens to come by. He said, I'm standing there. He goes, what's wrong? I said, I just ran that T-handle through the through that speaker. I said, so I said, I guess I'm probably packing my bags to leave. He said, oh, hell no. He said, that happens to everybody. Don't worry about it. I became the reconer, reconed hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of speakers, and ended up going back on the road. And so I just have a, George's, I don't hardly ever, and you can ask my wife, probably don't go, there's never a week I don't tell a George Wheatley story, because there's so many of them. He was good to me. I never said, no, I don't want to do anything, or I won't do it, whether it was Budweiser Superfest, and I'm sure there's a bunch of us in here that done none. Yeah. So anyway, but no matter what, I mean, I remember he came one time, he said, man, I got one for you here. It's just a one-off at reunion. But he said, I hate to even have, but he said, I need somebody. And it was easy. It was NWA and EZE. But I never said no. And because of that, he threw some good stuff my way, like Paul McCartney and ZZ Top. And so, yeah, he'll always be near and dear to me.
So I'm Doug Hall, and I started Choco in 78. JR hired me and worked in manufacturing with JR and George, and it was a great year or two over there. And I remember so much fun. Every Friday we'd kick off about 4, 5 o'clock, and George, and, oh, we weren't supposed to talk about that. They'd get a case of beer, and we'd all sit around. JR would tell road stories, and George, and they'd sit there, and they were the only guys there that had been touring, Bill McPherson. And they'd tell these stories, and I hadn't been on the road yet, and it's like JR could make you want to be on the Titanic, and, you know, some of these disasters, like, I gotta do this. But anyway, moved over into the sound department in 79, and after some personnel decisions that didn't quite go my way, I've departed, and on the way out the door, I said the wrong thing to B.J. Schiller, which I learned at the young age of 23 that just don't burn bridges, because it banished me to the world of corporate AV and rubber chicken and nightclubs at the Agora and stuff like that. And I'd call B.J. up about once a month and say, can I come back? He said, no. And so finally George took over that personnel position, and he was looking for somebody to do a corporate gig with Creative Services, Kirby, Mary Kay, and he called me up and he said, hey, I got one nobody wants to do these shows. I said, I'll do it, man. Send me out. So anyway, and finally got me back in, and did some really nice tours through the 90s, and every chance I got, I would tell George thank you. And last time I saw him, 2 years ago, we drove out to Longview and took him to lunch. We had some barbecue, and George, he had a cane at that point, but he was dressed nice and good spirits, and we had a good day, good lunch, and, you know, I took a chance again to tell him how much I appreciated him changing my life. You know, I mean, it was just overwhelming. you know, him and JR, I really give them a lot of credit. And I told George, I said, man, you're like George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. Because I say, you change a lot of guys' lives. You know, you're responsible for this. And we, you know, coming from me and all the other guys in the crews, we really appreciate it. So anyway, that was the last time I saw George. We exchanged a few texts after that, just wishing him well and I miss him. So thank you.
Well, this is a Jan Pessinger. Happy to be here. This is the first Shoko gathering that I've returned to since I left. How can you not be here to remember George? He was a rock. I worked with him for, I guess, 30-some years in some capacity. He was faithful and loyal, and we truly were his family. I could, you know, we could go on story after story talking about how faithful he was and how loyal he was. And until you really worked with him and saw his, that heart that was of gold underneath that firm exterior of cuss words and rigidity, you realize that he really, really did love people and service and would do anything that anybody asked him to do. Whether it was answering an alarm call at 2 a.m., whether it was dealing with stopped up toilets, which, as you can imagine, the line was very short for that job. There was not a lot of people who would respond, but George never complained. He might cuss, but it was not a complaint. I appreciate, JR, you sharing with us the story of George's last couple years of his life. I've wondered about him. I know that he was solitaire in his world. He didn't like to be needy. He didn't want to be dependent upon people. But bless you for stepping up and being there for that man, because he was there for so many of us. God must have put you in a place to respond, because I didn't know of his needs. I didn't know of his circumstances. I certainly would have done what I could if I had known, but you were the guardian angel that he needed. And certainly the story of the, George was not a technology guy, and obviously, most of us who had worked with him over the years knew how much he resisted. George kind of resisted change as well. But the two cell phones probably just sums it all up, you know, for all of us. George changed a lot of people's lives, and it's beautiful that so many people have come today to acknowledge him and remember him in such fondness and great, with such great memories. My stories were not near as exciting as the road stories. Stopped up toilets are about as glamorous it gets. Or a good roof leak. That was always good for a, got a, you know, blankety blank cuss words or whatever along the way. But, you know, Shoko is unique. Shoko, I thank Rusty for being there for all of us for so many years and being there supporting us, being just as faithful as George. And I'm so glad to see you today. Thank you for being here. I have many fond memories myself. I don't know when my day comes, if anybody will know or care. But thank you for being a part of my life and for shaping it and changing it in ways that I never could have done without you. Thank you for coming today. George, we know you're there. Thank you for being here too.
I'm sorry, but I got one more. This is great. This is funny.
I don't know how many people in this room were there. I'm sure some of you were. The day that George drove that forklift off the back dock. Remember that? We're all standing back there. He went to, I don't know how he got up on the dock plate, but it wasn't locked. And it just goes, and there he goes on that stand-up forklift. So anyway, so he's like, well, I won't say exactly what he said, but it's like this. So we're like, how are we going to get this thing back up? Because there's no ramp. So I think Lester Burton said, okay, here's what we can do. Remember the high line and it had the post and fence out there, the guardrail? So we hooked up a chain motor to one of those posts and got the forklift to be level again. And then we got plywood and some truck ramps. And it took a while, but we were all out there working on it. And I wish we had that on video. That was great. But we got that thing back up in the shop. But I had to tell that one because that, but the look on George's face when he just went right down with it and just stuck there. And I came by, you know, we're all like, well, he goes, what the hell are we going to do now? I said, I got to get back in the shop. But we figured it out. So there you go. You can always come up with a.
Hey there. We're going to come up as a tag team. Yeah. So I'm Mike Ponczak, Dr. Funk, to some known, and Tony. And I think I know most all of you, and I'm kind of more road than I was. So I missed out on all those early stories of the truck driving and all that. But one thing I can tell you about George is take a deep breath on this. He was my equalizer. And I'll tell you why on that, because I was one of the Fort Wankers, right? There's 7 Fort Wankers. Let me run down the list here. Yeah. You got Schertz, ML, Tom Hansen, Paul Strong, Biker, Ken Bosniak, and yeah, he was short, yeah. And Will Sharp. All right, so that's 7 Wankers. Oh, yeah, Mark Sharp. So that's 8. So we're talking Hoosier football right now. And they could be historically, you know, pretty good. No. But the truth is when I was first came down here, my first lunch, George says, we're going to go eat Mexican food. Have you ever had Mexican food? And I said, no. So we went to some place not that far from here, and I said, what is this garage? Escondidos. And that was my taste of Mexican food. Damn, I'm hooked. And Tony and I met, you know, at Jim's house.
Halloween party. Across the pool table.
Yeah, a pool table.
Which there was Mike.
I think he still has. Yeah, yes. There you are.
Yeah,
not quite.
Almost. He was standing. He was playing pool. I was on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all good. And here we are.
Like I said,
he's the equalizer. And I spent a lot of touring in Europe. But one thing, when I could get that overseas operator, George picked up the phone. I could get the Cowboys football score. And then he'd say, "Hey, you know, you got 280." Days on the road, you know, you need to take some time off when you get home. No, it didn't happen that way.
George and I were good friends. A few stories. I don't know what the deal is with his vehicles. I won't go into detail about when he helped us move. Mike was on the road, and there was a truck involved. And there was a Shoko truck involved, or a truck involved.
Yeah, we tore the roof off.
We won't go into detail. But then New Year's Eve, when him and Jenny were coming out to our house in Arlington, they were bringing the Black Eyed Peas. So his car died. There was no cell phones then. Cedar Hill 408. So they hitchhiked to Arlington, to our house. Yeah. And they spent the night, had a marvelous time, brought the Black Eyed Peas. So Mike and I took them to their car, and someone had rear-ended
it.
It told it his car. So that was our New Year's Eve with George and Jenny.
Black Eyed Peas everywhere.
Yeah. They left them in the cart. They didn't bring them to our house. So anyway, that's one story. There's a million. We were very good friends. I do miss him dearly. They did. I still have the knives he gave us when we got married.
Which?
The red ones with the...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he gave us a pizza set. So if I took a picture of this pizza pan, y'all would go, are they still using that? But it's seasoned well. We use it for bread and pizza and everything. But it's over 40-plus years old. And one of my birthdays when Mike was out of town, it was a big birthday. George gave me a gift. It was a bottle of Dom Perignon. I'd never had it before. He spoiled me rotten after that. So I love him dearly, and we're all good friends. Yeah. So you can tell a few other stories. I just wanted to tell that one.
We wanted to stick to the lasting memories of George.
Yeah.
And thanks so much for everybody
and
being here.
You all are all family, and we love you all. So thank you. Both of you were at our wedding. So.
Who's next? I'll adjust it for him.
Come on, Rusty. Rusty.
There we go.
Where's the 1-2?
Yeah, testing 1-2. There you go. Well, I'm really happy to be here, and
we're happy to see you.
Oh, really great to see everybody. You know, Deb and I, my wife. And here's my granddaughter, Ella. David and Allie and I were rooming together at the Land's Inn Apartments in 1969. And David had a date with a girl named Barbara, and he decided to do a blind date, and she had a friend named Debbie. And so we did this blind date, and Deb and I got married 6 months later. Yeah. So Debbie had a friend named George Wheatley. And George was working for Dallas Power and Light. And they had informed him that if he did not cut his hair, they were going to fire him. And you can imagine how that went down. He saved him the trouble. And he and Debbie were out somewhere, and he was talking about it. He needed a job, that he just left Dallas Power and Light. And Deb said, well, I'm dating this guy, and he's, I'm not real sure what he does, but one thing you know for sure is you won't have any trouble with long hair, so you ought to give him a call. So George gave me a call, and I was had one in Kevin, and I needed another road guy to go with me and do Zeppelin. So I hired George, and the three of us went out and in Loretta and did the Zeppelin's tour in 1970 and 71, and then followed it right on to James Taylor, doing the Carole King Tapestry Tour. And George was just, he was just such a hard worker and such a, you know, that gruff exterior. He was such a good guy, you know, and he really represented the best of all of us, I think. I really miss him a lot. But, you know, it's been such a honor, really, to have done Shoko and to have everybody that went through there and contributed. It became, you know, it's all about the people that were there. Because all the things we did were just so extraordinary at the time. And when we first started, you know, we had all those things we needed to do, and there was no place to go to get it. You know, there wasn't a rigging company, and there wasn't a trucking company, and there wasn't people to build trusses for you. So we had to do all that stuff and invent it as we went along. And it was the people that all of you and all the other people that came through there that made all that happen. And it was really an extraordinary thing that we accomplished. I'm immensely proud of all of us for doing it. And I was really happy, bittersweet, of course, when we did the deal with Clare Brothers. But, you know, Clare is really, of all the companies in the industry that have consolidated and bought other companies and stuff, Clare Brothers has really done a great job integrating Shoko and the other companies they've bought into a really fine company that's not controlled by private equity money. It's a family business. And I really feel like Shoko's DNA and all that is present in the industry. And we basically revolutionized and created the sound industry out of nothing, because when we started, there wasn't anything. When we decided to start Shoko, and Jack Maxton and Jack Calmes and I decided to go into the business after we did the Pop Festival in Louisville in 1969, Bill Hanley did the sound for it. And I had been building sound systems all in the 60s for the band that we had, and also for nightclubs and things. And I saw that big system that Bill Hanley had. I'd never seen anything quite like that. It was, he used all Altec equipment that he got from movie theaters, so it was really giant stuff, multi-cell horns and W-bends, and he used Macintosh 350-watt amplifiers, which were a great piece of equipment, but they were gigantic and they cost a fortune. But he had 14 of them at the Louisville Pop Festival, and he'd built a Visqueen room under the scaffolding, and he had window air conditioners in there trying to cool these things because it was 100 degrees, and then the 14,000 watt amp, or 350 watt amps in there. So anyway, after that, after seeing that, we decided, that Maxson and Clark and I, to start the company. So on March 3rd, 1970, we went to the lawyer's office and incorporated a company, and we put $1,000 into it, $300 a piece. Maxson didn't have $300, so he put a voltmeter in the as his part of it. So we had $600 and a voltmeter. But it was a Hewlett Packard, so you know, it was first class. And our first gig, Terry Bassett had come down to Dallas from Seattle as to start Concerts West in Dallas. And Concerts West had started up in Seattle. It was founded by Danny Kaye, the actor. And they were the very first company to start promoting shows in arenas. And their first big act was Creedence Clearwater Revival. And when Bassett came to Dallas, he wanted to start promoting shows, and there were no sound systems to do it. So he called up Calmes somehow and started renting the sound system I built for this band we had, Soul Society. And so we did a few gigs at McFarlane Auditorium. We did The Grateful Dead, and I met Bear Osley, who was the famous, I didn't realize that at the time, but he was called the Acid King because he had sold 1.2 million doses of acid in the L.A. San Francisco area. And so he was, he came to the gig in McFarlane Auditorium, and he said, told me that he could hear the electrons in the vacuum tubes in the power amps, and he got a special connection, and his goal was to have a dimensional happening for the gig. So I never knew what that was, but we got through the gig okay. So Bassett, he wanted to do more gigs. He wanted to start promoting in McFarlane Auditorium, and Memorial Auditorium. And so when we started, when we decided to incorporate, we knew we had to build a bigger system. And I wanted to use JBL equipment because I had seen a Beach Boys gig in the mid-60s where they used JBL speakers, and I was just blown away with them. They were so much better than the Altec equipment that I had been using. So I said to myself, I want to use JBL if we ever do anything on a big scale. So we bought JBL equipment, and our first gig was Leslie West. And that was on February 23rd, 1970. It was actually before we actually incorporated. So, but Max and I bought the gear, and we put it together in his garage, and we went down to the gig, which was at the Dallas Music Hall, and we'd asked the JBL systems engineer, a guy named Walter Dick, to recommend the gear for this, and we wanted the ultimate sound system for rock and roll, is what we told him. And so he specified 2 15-inch rear-loaded cabinets for bass on each side of the stage and 2 lens horns on each side of the stage with a 2470 1-inch driver on each horn. He said, going to cover anything, no worries. Now, why we believe that, I don't know. But it seemed like the thing to do at the time. So we bought the stuff, went down there and set it up. Leslie West shows up with a semi and starts unloading Sun guitar amplifiers out of this semi. And they start at stage left, and they do a row of Sun bass cabinets all the way to stage right. And then they start again on stage left, and they stack them on too high, and they go all the way to stage right. So they had about, 20 or 30 2-inch double 15 cabinets all powered up with Sun amplifier heads, and they had probably 3 or 4 times more power than we did in our sound system. So when the gig started, you couldn't hear a word of the vocal, nothing. It was a disaster. So that was our first thing and foray into the business, and we went home after that gig and realized that we really didn't have a clue what it was going to take to do this business we'd created, And so we just got the JBL catalog out and we just said, we're going to have to just drastically increase the amount of gear that we're going to use here. And so we basically increased it by a factor of 10. And we went with double 15 bass cabinets, a bunch of them, and the old radial 2350 horns. And we stayed with 2470 drivers. We just used a lot of them. And we went with the Marantz 16B power amplifiers. And we started building racks full of the vertical racks, with the mixers, went to 24 channels. And that's how it all started. And so the first gig we got after we upgraded was Zeppelin. And they came through Memorial Auditorium, Memorial, in April of 1970. And they had been using one-off systems, because in those early days of touring, the promoter was responsible for providing the sound. And so they'd go to one town and they'd get a sound system from whatever thrown together, and then they go to the next town and be completely different, and all of them were bad. So when they showed up at Memorial Auditorium, the system we had built was quite large, relatively speaking, and they loved it. And so I just went on the road. I put the gear in went down and rented a Ryder truck, and we loaded up the gear in the truck and took off and started touring with them. And then we started building a second system, and Maxon came through and did Three Dog Night. It was the next big act that Terry Bassett booked. The same thing happened again. They loved it. And so Maxon loaded the stuff up in the Ryder truck and took off and started doing Three Dog. And that's how the whole thing started. And then we needed other people, and so we started hiring people one at a time. And before you knew it, the thing was up to 8 systems. And it was just this constant evolution of trying to make the equipment better and more reliable and louder and progressing up the technology ladder from the 2-way systems to 3-way to 4-way and then the pyramid system and then prism in the 86. But it was all, done with all the people, all of you and everybody there that contributed to those things, all the woodshop guys. I mean, we produced enormous numbers of cabinets of every shape and size and all the wiring. You know, Greg Bright ran the shop and John Ray, the electronics areas and stuff. So it was kind of a learn as you go. We weren't acoustical experts. We didn't, Kenny Whitwright came on board and provided immense technical help at the time we needed it. And then after him, Jim Brawley came, and he was the one that really was the driving force, along with Clay and Richard Bratcher behind Prism. But I'm really proud of what we did and the huge numbers of shows. You know, Jim Bornhorst obviously did so much work with all the electronics, and the Superboard was such a huge thing that we did in 1973. He and I and Ron Fox built the first Superboard, and then we built 7 more. We had a total of 8, and those really carried the company for about 10 years. And so many of us learned how to mix and learned how to do shows on the Superboard, and they were really wonderful pieces of gear. They still work. Jim donated Superboard A to the museum in Kilgore, the television museum, run by Chuck Conrad, and it still works, right? The console still worked. And so I'm really, as I say, and then obviously we decided to go into lighting, and that happened in 72. One of the gigs that we did between Led Zeppelin's tour in 71 and James Taylor was we were hired to do the Jesus Christ Superstar touring show in New York City. And I went up there and did the rehearsals and did the first few shows and met a guy named John Tedesco, who was on the lighting crew up there. And so when we decided to go into lighting, I called him up and said, hey, will you come and consult with us and help us kind of get the lighting thing going? And he came down, and he was the one that came up with the idea of the air towers and the case with the rack of parkhands on it and punch a button and the tower would go up. And we built a bunch of those. And an interesting side story on that is that a guy named Michael Tate came to Dallas to see that. And he said he represented Yes. He said he was the lighting designer for Yes. And he wanted to talk to us about renting our air towers for the Yes tour. So I toured him all around Shoko at the time, showed him the towers, explained how it all worked, and he went off and never heard from him. And then a little bit later, all of a sudden, hear about these Tate towers, and then that's what he went home and built his own for Yes. And but what's interesting is that he has built that company, Tate, into the biggest staging company in the world. It's just gigantic. It's just unbelievably huge, and it's up there in Lititz along with Clare Brothers. So and we did our best at building sets. We tried for years to build sets, and it just, that is a very difficult thing to do. And my hat's off to Michael Tate for figuring out how to do it. But it's been a interesting thing, and we started the lighting thing, and then turned into Varilite and Jim's brilliant idea of dichroic filters and metal halide lamps, and and the rest is history. But it all came from all of us. So
props to Kirby.
And Kirby. I should have mentioned, of course, Kirby, because we hired Kirby. We needed somebody to run the lighting department. And I can't remember how we got introduced to Kirby, but he had just graduated from Ohio State. He was the drum major, the guy out there with the big pom-pom, you know, doing the thing. And he had a degree in theater. And so he came in and put the lighting department together, hired some wonderful people. He was another one of those just extraordinary people that just had such a work ethic and such a, he was just, you know, he was one of those people that told you the truth. He told you exactly what he's thinking all the time. He didn't mince any words, but he was just an amazing guy. And we lost him to AIDS in the 80s. It was terrible. Along with Gary Sawyer too. But, you know, the lighting evolved into Varilight because we had to solve a problem. We needed to figure out a way to put more lights up and make things more interesting. And we'd been working on a color-changing idea for several years, trying to make a park hand change color. And I asked Jim to take a look at it finally because we couldn't come up with an idea, and he came up with the idea of the Mark 350 with dichroic filters, and that was really the beginning of a whole another industry that was completely revolutionized by what we've done. So I feel very proud of us to have had such impact in the industry and been part of creating it. Because in 1969, it didn't exist. There was no touring industry. There weren't any concert sound systems. There was no lights. The first 2 years of the Shoko, that we didn't have any lighting on the stage. It was just the band and the PA. That's it. Everything was done with follow spots. And so the lighting didn't come in until we did the lighting towers. That was the very first touring lighting system, and then that emerged, evolved into trusses and figuring out how to lift the trusses. Started out with ground support, then we went to rigging with chain motors, and hired Al Kane from Rhode Island, a rigger, to come down, and he was another character, you know, person, a typical East Coast guy, you know. I mean, yeah, but he could walk those beams. I was terrified of heights. I couldn't imagine doing what he did. That guy would get up there and casually walk out on those beams 200 feet up in the air and sit down and wrap it with burlap and pull up a chain motor chain with wire rope and tie it off. I mean, good grief. And that was a whole other area of the company. We had to create was rigging. All that equipment and all the techniques and the maintenance of all the gear and all the motors and all that stuff. So it's really been a ride. I mean, if you think about it, wow, who would have thought that starting out with Leslie West kicking the mic stand off the stage in my face that we would overcome that and end up doing something with it. But that actually was one of the best things that ever happened to us, was to fail at that level so quick, because it forced us to react immediately and immediately build a big system for the time. And that's one reason why it worked. That's why Zeppelin loved it when they came through and used it. It's why Three Dog liked it, is because it was big enough to be heard at the time. If you look back on it, I'm sure the sound of it was not that good compared to what you can get now, but it was good enough to do the work, you know. So anyway, I really am happy to see everybody, and I just want to say how much we miss George. What a huge impact he had. He stayed with us the entire time, his whole career, from the first day that we went together in did that tour with Zeppelin and James. He just always was there. He was do anything, do any job. He was always there. And I really, really appreciate him. Thank you.
Rusty, do you and Kevin remember what employee number he was? Zero to 10, did you say?
Between
zero and 10. Okay, so we're just a little after 2:30, and we're going to have to kind of... You want to say one more thing? All right.
To every man, woman, and granddaughter here, I got one question, and would everybody raise your hand? If Rusty wants to start another company, are we all going to battle with him, all right? All right.
So Fort Wayne thinks they have the ultimate employee list. It's Thomas Jefferson High School in Dallas, Texas. With at least 8.
Okay, folks coming back.
That is so true. That is so true, just out of state. But I'd also like to thank Sherry and Bob for getting this together and for Indigo and Gilbert for carrying on some of the things and historical things that happened online. Thank you.